Time for another Dear Jane. I'm Scott. She's Marcy. How are you?
I'm great.
So today we're, you know, we love talking. It's almost like we love talking to people we disagree with. That's not right.
We disagree with them on certain things. Like I would say,
yes,
people that the thing we have in common,
yes,
is our pro-life
state. We do here on Dear Jane what you see less and less of in the culture, and that is finding common ground. What do we agree on, and then how can we make some progress there? We don't see that much anymore, and that's what we love to do here on Dear Jane. Today we're going to talk to Teresa Bukovnak. All right, we've had her on before. She ran as a presidential candidate and in the Democrat Party, but she has also been very, very involved in Justice for the Five, which I know you're passionate about too.
Yeah.
You dope.
I wasn't expecting you to stop there.
Hey, Jacob.
You're hearing more and more from us, Jacob. I don't
know. That's a good thing. Let's see here. What's a good place? All right, back when I was about to say her name. Okay. Today, we're going to visit with Teresa Bukovnak, who has been on the show before. She is very, very progressive, very, very much an atheist, into civil disobedience and all that. But she is very, very passionate about Justice for the Five, which I know is something you've been passionate for a long time as well, haven't you?
Yeah, it's just, it's kind of a, it leaves me speechless just thinking about it. Like, it's a very chilling story. And I am so inspired by the bravery of Teresa and Lauren and others who are involved in this. You'll hear Teresa tell that story again today. So if you haven't heard that before, if you missed our earlier episode with her, you can hear it. But it's just, it's, I always think I can't be more shocked by things going on in the abortion industry. And then I hear something like Justice for the Five, and I just can't believe that this happens.
Yeah. So before we talk to Teresa, make sure you subscribe, you hit the bell, you pound the thing, you hit the all those things that you're supposed to do to make sure that you get notified when there's a new Dear Jane. There's a new Dear Jane every week. You should know that by now. But make sure you do that. Make sure you tell your friends. Very quickly, we want to tell you about our partnership with My Body, My Voice, brand new, hot off the presses. This is going to be a game changer for the pro-life movement. Marcy, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, My Body, My Voice is a collaboration between Abortion Survivors Network, so many of you know Melissa Odin and her story, and Cogency Strategic, and Nellie Roach, the president there. We've had her on before to tell her story, and it's the whole project is going to be a different set of series of stories of people who have been impacted by abortion, but their stories have been silenced because they don't follow the mainstream pro-abortion narrative. So we're super excited. The website just launched. It's launching with 5 stories of abortion survivors. So you really need to check it out. We'll post the link in the episode notes so you can get to it easily. But it's just, again, you talk about being shocked again by what happens in the abortion industry and the lengths to which people will go to silence voices. These are 5 powerful, powerful stories. So you'll want to go check it out, share it on social media. My Body, My Voice, helping tell the stories of people who have been impacted by abortion.
Yeah, and I've had a chance to preview some of those, and those are, they're just moving. And I mean, what impressive people they are, and how they tell their story, and it's just very, very interesting. I think it's the start of something big.
Today on Dear Jane, we visit with Teresa Bukovnak, the founder and executive director of Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising. Hope you enjoy this conversation.
Teresa, thanks for joining us here today on Dear Jane. Lots of things to cover. You had a very interesting 2024. One of the things, I had an opportunity to hear you at the March for Life, at the Law of Life Summit, and You are very, very passionate talking about justice for the five. And we've talked about that before. Give us sort of a refresher course for people who aren't familiar with that story and that situation. Tell us about that and where we are with that.
Sure. It's pretty much the most important thing in my life since it happened. So it's a great honor for me to be able to come and give them a voice on your podcast today. In 2022, on March 25th, which just happens to be the day of the unborn child, we didn't know it at the time, but Lauren Handy, my colleague and I, went to the Washington Surgery Center. It's an all-term abortion center in Washington, D.C. We went there with the intention of doing a civil disobedience and helping moms in crisis. We showed up to the abortion center, and outside we saw a truck parked, and it was labeled Curtis Bay Medical Waste Services. And we'd been doing this a while. We know that that means it's probably dead babies. So without even a word, we just walked up to the driver. You know, we hadn't talked to each other or, you know, communicated, like, what are we going to do? We just acted immediately. And I just said, do you know what's in these boxes? And the driver said, no. And I said, it's dead babies. And I said, would you get in trouble if we took one of these? And he thought about it, and he said, well, what would you do if I gave it to you? And Lauren said, we'll give him a funeral and a burial. And he said, okay. So she took the box, and immediately we panicked. We had, like, you know, no idea what was about to happen. I thought for sure when he said, okay, I was going to turn around and Lauren was going to be like, no. But, like, I turned around and she already had it in her hand. So, like, we both had already committed in that moment, like, we're going through with this. We're going to find out what's in this box, and we're going to figure out how to make it, you know, worth it. And so we just panicked and brought it back to her apartment. We talked to everybody we could think of, lawyers, anybody who'd ever handled fetal remains. We didn't know for sure that it would be, you know, fetal remains necessarily. It's medical waste. It could be bloody gauze, could be just about anything. But I think we were really kind of preparing ourselves for seeing, like a pulverized arm or a leg, you know, something that we knew was going to be a very emotional experience for us, something that we were, like, scared to see. Lauren had seen some fetal remains before, and she was still just like, you know, I don't know if I want to do this, but, you know, we really already were there. Like, what are you going to do? Like, and so we turned on a camera, invited a photographer over and a reporter and a Catholic deacon. I'm an atheist, but Lauren is a Catholic. And we opened the box, and inside we found dozens of these small turquoise containers called Whirlpacks. Lauren recognized them immediately and said, it's babies, it's all babies, which of course was our fear. But we weren't expecting them to be individually packaged in that way. But they were spilling out a little bit. They were just thrown into a bag, and like a biohazard bag. And as we began to unpack them and, you know, we're processing what's happening, Lauren reached into the bottom, and there was another bag at the bottom that had more buckets in it, bigger buckets, five of them. And so, you know, it just immediately we knew, I think, that our lives were going to change in that moment. It's like, you know how big these babies have to be in these buckets. And, like, what are you going to do? Just run out of the room and leave them there? And, like, I mean, we had to keep moving forward. So, you know, Lauren took the largest bucket and set it on the table, and she, you know, had double gloves on her hands. She reached her hands into the bucket and she said, this baby's whole. And, you know, we've all been doing this a long time. We know what that means when we're talking about a whole baby this size. Like, this is a horror show. And she pulls out of the bucket the most beautiful baby boy. He was just pink and totally huge. Like, we regularly use a 22-week-old fetal model in our activism. And this baby was at least twice that size. Like, we knew we were looking at a really, really well-developed child. And, you know, you could see his face and his the hairs on his head and stolen future. And it was just horrific. It's like literally staring at like the worst possible thing you can imagine in the world. And, you know, with your own two eyes, not just hearing about it, but like literally seeing it. And anyways, so we put them back in the solution. They were in some kind of like formaldehyde and spent days desperately trying to find a pathologist who could evaluate this their condition and give any kind of indication as to their cause of death. I mean, obviously, one of them, who we named Harriet, appears to be a victim of partial birth abortion. Just very clear indications, like a cut in the back of the skull. Her brain was suctioned out. Her skull was crushed, and she had one eye kind of like blown open in the process. So when we opened the bucket, she's like staring right at us. And, you know, you could just see her long foot. She had this very long foot. You could tell she was just, you know, going to be so tall and beautiful. And, you know, she was just murdered by this monster who does this every single day in Washington, D.C. It's like his specialty, Cesare Santangelo. And so we knew we're looking at probably federal crimes, and that, you know, we know immediately we need an autopsy and investigation. So we're searching for private pathologists because we certainly don't trust the police. But then time was going by, and I mean, we made dozens and dozens and dozens of contacts. I personally spoke with probably 50 plus people trying to find, I mean, we were just absolutely exhausted. We were up for days. Like, what do you do? Like, just in panic mode. And, no, the world didn't know anything at this point. You know, it was just us kind of dealing with this. But, at one point we decided we do need to hand these over to the police and ask for an autopsy. We're not going to be able to find a private pathologist. And to this day, we still have not found a private pathologist willing to examine these babies. So if any of your viewers have any connections with anyone who might have some expertise in this area, we certainly welcome, you know, to connect any opportunity to connect with them. So we had attorneys, issue a letter to the DCPD and the medical examiner, just letting them know we had the remains of these children, and we were asking them for an autopsy and to pick them up. In the meantime, Lauren and I, there was a priest who did a funeral for unbaptized children in front of the refrigerator where we had stored them temporarily, and we gave him the 110 to bury in an undisclosed location somewhere in the area. And they were given a Catholic funeral and a burial. And we arranged to have the other five taken by the police. But when the police told us to leave the door open and they would come in and get them. So we left the door open. We went to my apartment. And when we woke up the next morning to go make sure that they had taken them, when we got to the sidewalk, the FBI was there and they said, Lauren Handy, you're under arrest. And they took her into custody on the sidewalk for this action that she had done at Santangelo's clinic 2 years before this. So we don't really know what's going on. I mean, we certainly knew that there was a potential for federal charges for that action, but that was years ago. And, you know, you just kind of think that's, I guess that's not happening. So then when it did happen, we're like, okay, it's happening. But weird timing, right? And then, so the, I went back in the apartment after the feds left with Lauren in custody and the babies were still there. And then the police contacted us, said, oh, we're coming today. And then they showed up with, you know, homicide and just made a huge scene of it with the press and shut down the block. And then, you know, the police ended up leaking the story to the press and just trying to kind of like turn the story against Lauren, kind of trying to turn her into this like creepy villain person who would like keep dead babies in her apartment. That was like what all the headlines were about. Like, you know, I'm talking like New York Times, Washington Post. This was an enormous story. And the story obviously wasn't like some guy in Washington, D.C. is torturing and murdering children. It's Lauren had dead babies in her house. What a creep fest. She should be sent to federal prison. And that's literally what happened. She did end up going to prison. She had to face a jury in DC years after all of this media that was so targeted against her. But then, you know, now she has been pardoned by Trump, and she is out of prison along with the other rescuers. And so now we are in a much better position to pursue justice for the five than we were before. And, you know, so grateful to Lorne and the others' sacrifice in their imprisonment, because otherwise, I think, you know, when Lorne and I first opened the box and saw Christopher X, who was we named the first baby that she opened. I just remember us sobbing and thinking, who's gonna care about this? Like, no one is gonna care. And the fact that President Trump pardoned them, and there is congressional interest in hosting in ho having hearings for these babies, and we need justice for these babies, and that means accountability for their killer. And I think that we are much closer today than we were before they made this great sacrifice.
Yeah. I've heard you tell these stories before. I've read all about it, and it doesn't ever get easier. I know it doesn't get easier for you to share it. I want to come back to the pardons and all of that, but sticking with the Justice for the Five, just for a little bit, there was some movement on this last year. You launched a presidential campaign. Talk to us about, I know we had you on before and you shared, you know, part of the reason, or maybe the whole reason, was to try to bring awareness to this Justice for the Five campaign. How did that go? How was that received? I know in at least a few states you were able to air commercials telling their stories. So how did that go? How was it received? What were the reactions to all of that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'm so glad I did that, and I really want to encourage other people to do the same. I really don't want to be the only person that does this, not because I'm afraid of standing out, I'm not, but because I want us to be successful as a movement. And I think it's just a major tool that we are not utilizing, to try to reach people, to show them what abortion really does. The thing that the other side is trying desperately to censor, I want to see us desperately trying to uncensor it by showing the truth. And I was able to show ads depicting the five babies that I found, with the pictures that I took, to millions of viewers, literally in the New York area. And I received 14,000 votes in New Jersey alone in the Democrat primary. I kept Biden from getting 90% in New Jersey. I took a chunk. I took There was like a district where I had 100% of the votes. So there is a future for pro-life Democrats. So it's incredibly encouraging for me. Even in New Hampshire, I came in like right in the middle of all the lesser known candidates. I beat out half of them, and the half that beat me out, like half of them actually live in New Hampshire. So like, I did no campaigning in New Hampshire. I just ran some ads in Boston on Jimmy Fallon and The View and the News, and it was enough. You know, people really are moved by those images. They're like, oh yeah, no, I don't want to be complicit in that. I didn't know that's what it looked like, or I forgot that that's really happening. And I'm just so grateful for, I got the idea from Randall Terry. You know, he did it before a long time ago, and then he ended up doing it again after I ran in the primaries. He ran in the general on the Constitution Party ticket and did the same thing. He ran nonstop ads showing dead babies in swing states, particularly Wisconsin. And you cannot convince me that that didn't have a significant effect on Trump winning these swing states. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a lot of power in this tactic. And I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep going. It's hard. Like, the fundraising part is really hard. The pro-life movement treats you differently when you're a candidate. It's like, you're not as welcome in some of these C3 spaces. And I really... You know, I'm on a mission to try to repair that in the pro-life movement. There has to be better cooperation between candidates and nonprofits and how the movement works together. But we need more candidates. And we don't even have to be real candidates. We can just show people the dead babies and then we will be doing our job.
Well, because it's so easy for people to just get away with using the word abortion and never think about what it is.
You know, a side note, you just said something about the C3 space. Let's just say pro-life C3s are needlessly timid. And we'll just leave it there. We'll revisit that another day.
Understatement of the century.
Yeah. So so people don't understand. So people don't, you keep talking about the tactic. You did a really good job at Law of Life explaining what it is, when you run for president like this, that enables you to show stuff that otherwise might be suppressed. Kind of briefly help us understand that.
Yeah, federal law requires any TV station with an FCC license to run the ads of any federal candidate uncensored. That's the law. It's very well enforced. And the networks are pretty terrified of violating that. So there's really no threat of censorship.
That's cool.
That's a neat opportunity. I hope that plants a seed for people to.
Me too. And look, television ads these days are not expensive. They're not like they used to be. The ads I bought on Jimmy Fallon in Boston reached millions of people, and they cost me $450 a piece.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what about the? Let's talk about the Justice for the Five. And there was some news recently that I guess there's a new U.S. attorney in the D.C. area, Ed Martin, if I remember that correctly.
That's right.
What do we hope he is able to do here in 2025?
You know, that's a great question. I'm still kind of trying to figure out what we need from who. I think that, you know, the primary concern here is that we want a federal investigation. We want the DOJ involved in this. But I think at least in the short run, Ed Martin is certainly positioned to help bring Santangelo to justice, to if we could get an investigation into the investigation of the five. We know, you know, I'm quite confident that an investigation did happen, but we just don't have the details to that. I think Ed Martin can get us that. I think that he can follow up with the health department and find out why they're not enforcing any of the laws. I think that he can, you know, follow up with DCPD and hold them accountable for, you know, for the cover up. And I think that, you know, I'm very optimistic about having Ed Martin as the district attorney. I think it is extremely encouraging, and I just couldn't have really envisioned a better pick. So,
good.
Yeah.
I think we're in a good position.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm so tired of people saying, "Oh, partial birth abortions don't happen," or "Abortions don't happen this late in pregnancy," and hopefully.
Is Santangelo still doing his thing?
Every day. What's today? Tuesday? Yeah, Tuesday is a killing day for him.
And what's the response of, I mean, do they say, nuh-uh? I mean, what do they say to defend themselves?
I mean, they don't really have to say much. I mean, they're not in a position to have to defend themselves. I think, like, the National Abortion Federation defends him for him, and they would say probably something like, well, you know, as long as he cuts the cord beforehand, it's legal. Or, you know, I really don't think that he is. I think that, like, Phoenix, for example, who's totally in his amniotic sac, like, there wouldn't have been a way to cut the cord in that case, but he might try to say that in the case of Christopher X. There's a lot of different ways that you can say, like with a partial birth abortion, for example, because there's no real enforcement mechanism, he can just say, I didn't intend to do a partial birth abortion, but then it turned out that I had to. You know, there's ways that the law gives them places to hide. But he hasn't even really had to use any of them because he's totally protected by the mayor, by the DCPD, and by an entire political party and the entire abortion industrial complex. Like, they need to preserve people like Santangelo because he's willing to do their dirtiest of work.
Yeah. Well, I hope justice comes soon. Switching back, I want to circle back around to Lauren and the other pro-life activists who were pardoned. Where were you when you heard that they had been pardoned? Have you spoken to them? Kind of walk us through what that was like. How are they doing now?
So, you know, we were working really hard after Trump got elected to make sure that we were getting the right thing from the Trump administration. And it's kind of difficult because, you know, we do want the face, the appeal to continue in the court, because we want face to be found unconstitutional in the court, as well as it to be abolished by the legislature. My good friend, Harmeet Dhillon was appointed to Assistant Attorney General, and my friend Ed Martin has been appointed to, as you know, the DA of Washington, D.C., and I knew both of them were very closely connected with the group of people who were making these decisions about the pardons. And so, you know, we made sure that they had all the information. And when, you know, Trump had promised that he would pardon them on day one, and then day one, you know, I flew into D.C. the night before the inauguration in the hopes that he was going to pardon them. And, you know, my associate Caroline and I were glued to the TV the entire day. And of course, nothing, dancing well into the night. Nothing about the pro-life political prisoners. And so the next morning we went up to Capitol Hill and we just lit a fire under everyone's ass. And, you know, it was really easy because they all really cared about it. Like, almost every member's staff was like, you know, it's so horrible that they're still in prison. We're definitely going to get all of this information to the members. And, you know, they really did kind of roll out the red carpet for us a little bit going to the Hill that day. And they said that they had received other calls. And we went to, I don't know, 25, 30 offices. And we're just like, please, just whatever connections you have, whoever you know, please get them out. And so everyone was saying, well, you know, he's probably planning on doing it at the March for Life. But we just like, we're not in the mood to wait for that. And like,
the heck so with then, theater.
yeah, really.
You know, we go home that night, and that's Tuesday, right? The day after the inauguration was Tuesday. And then, so we go home that night. We're like, all right, we've done what we can do. Wednesday morning, we got up. We had an action planned outside Rayburn House office building, and we had two of our activists arrested, you know, demanding hearings for the five babies, justice for the five. And so I had two activists in custody, and I was in an Uber on my way back to the Law of Life Summit. Yeah. And, because then somebody said something there, and I was like, no, not yet.
Yeah, somebody said he's pardoned him, but it was not yet official.
Right. Yeah, it was Missy that was saying that. Yeah. So I was like, oh, I don't know. All this is happening. You know, I got these people in custody. I totally forgot to even mention that at the Law of Life Summit. It's like, oh, hey, we've got some people in jail right now. And like, I think right after I spoke, mm-hmm. that it was like, he's signing it. So I ran down to find Caroline and, you know, we hugged, cried. She was on the phone with Lauren when it happened. And they're like, we thought for sure, even if they got pardoned, you know, the process would take a while for them to get out. But no, they all got out that night. And it was awesome. Like Herb ended up coming to D.C. the next day and was there by the evening. And we had a big welcome home party for him at the Pow House. And I mean, just being in that, even in like a Zoom meeting and Lauren's there and Herb is there, it's like, oh, this is the best. Like I missed them so much. And in a way, it's like, I think we're all starting to kind of feel our feelings about what's happened, because it's like, we were all in this, like, you know, they're like, okay, I got to endure this prison situation. And me and the rest of the team are like, well, we've got to get these guys out. And now we're like, what the hell have we been through? This is insane. Like it's been a huge sacrifice in so many ways. But you know, you look at other movements and what's needed to really move the needle, and we're barely even scratching the surface of like real courage. You know, like, yeah, we can do a year in jail, a year and a half. Like it sucks and it's horrible, but it's like, it also still kind of empowers you. And their example reminds me that like, yes, it can be done. And that's the very least that I should be doing given the situation. And I want to show other people that they can do it too. And although you do pay a big price, you have the fulfillment of not just knowing you're doing the right thing and aligning your values with your actions, but seeing real results that you created. Like none of this would be happening if they had not planned this action 5 years ago. If me and Lauren hadn't been going and doing rescues and running into, you know, dead baby drivers, we put so many years into creating this moment for Congress, for people who have real political power to wield it on behalf of these babies. And I can't even tell you what that level of satisfaction feels like. And you can feel it too. All of your listeners.
Yeah. And you know, Seth, you said something interesting there. We're starting to feel the feelings now or something like that. You know, it was interesting when you were telling the story, and this is the third time now I've heard you tell the story of that day when you took the box home. Clearly still emotional for you. You've told that 1,000 times, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Clearly still emotional. How has it changed your life?
I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, it has changed my life, certainly. But I was already on this trajectory, you know? I already knew what abortion was. I knew intimately. I was very involved in exposing fetal organ harvesting practices at UCSF, which is one of the reasons I knew exactly what we were looking at when we saw it. I know about this stuff. But, like, I didn't know it until I knew it. And then it's just, I don't know, you just remember the moment and it's like, you can't, like when you see that kind of hatred and you just really kind of remember it. I don't know. I am always surprised by the times that I do get emotional and the times I'm just like, oh, that was fine. Like I could just tell it. I don't know. I don't know why it strikes me sometimes, but it just, you can live it again and remember like, just, I don't know, just the hateful nature of man. I can't really describe it much more than that.
Yeah.
Not of all men, of course, but like, no, you know, of some people, it's horrific what people are capable of and what they just do for a living. And I know that like when Santangelo goes places, people like probably run up to him and throw their arms around him and call him a hero. And it's like, I cannot let that stand. And I'm very committed to making sure that they have a voice and that they're seen and that we really can change things for them. And Yeah, I guess it's kind of important, right? It's like, would I take it back? No. I mean, look at where we are now. Yeah. Have I had to suffer because of it? Sure. But like, you know, I'm not dismembered, and, you know, it's going to take that. And there is a good feeling in being a person that can follow through and, you know, be there for them in the way they need.
Yeah. I think it's for my own self, I've often thought it's a gift to still be able to feel all of that, but not to feel it so intensely every day. Cause I think that it would just be crippling if we fully felt the reality of what we're up against every single day. I don't know if we could do it, honestly. So I think it's a gift that we can feel it and we do feel it, but that we also have days that seem easier. As we start to wrap up, I just had a couple other questions for you. Obviously we have a new president in office. And I'm curious, cause you run a progressive pro-life organization, which a lot of people in the pro-life movement are like, what is that? How did those two things work together? And I love that you have such a presence in the pro-life movement and have brought so many different people in. I'm curious for you, how do you see progressives and the new Trump administration working together over the next few years?
I think we're definitely going to be able to work with the Trump administration. I think that the Trump administration signals, from what I can tell, that they really want to unify America, or that the messaging is built around unification. And I think that progressive pro-lifers can certainly help that. And I think that the ways that we are giving the pro-life movement a boost is outside of whether or not you support abortion, really. I mean, these are about federal crimes. These are about crimes against, you know, moms who are being lied to about the nature of what's about to happen to their baby. Civil rights violations, really, in the abortion industrial complex. And I think that the Trump administration is positioned to address those issues without even having to say we're against abortion. And I think that that's where we're going to be able to do a lot of work together. I really hope that the Trump administration includes me in any kind of like advisory committees on abortion, or even on these issues of civil rights violations within the industry. I think that as a progressive, I would have a really unique perspective that could be really beneficial to that unification goal. And, you know, obviously have a lot of other concerns about other issues, not super excited about the drill baby drill thing. I'm sure I'll tell Trump that in person one day. But yeah, I think on the life issue, even though, you know, it was so soul crushing, really, to see Trump back away from the issue and essentially say he's pro-choice and strong arming the GOP. It's like, this guy is a baby killer times a thousand. But like, I was overreacting a little bit. And I think that there's a lot that we can get done. And I think, you know, Trump is strategic. I do. But I also, you know, believe what he says. And when he says, like, he's not going to help us make abortion illegal. He's not.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could be worse. And I think what we have now is really workable. You know, I think that what the pro-life movement was working with before was just was just too broad. It's like, well, we just are against all abortions, and that's just not where most people are. And we see that. And in order to move the needle, I think I've been saying for years, and David DeLayden's been saying for years, we really have to focus on these very like serious cases of late term abortion, not like the problems of, you know, sex before marriage and like I think that Trump has kind of maybe strategically put us in a position where we might gain more ground this way. I don't know. I'm optimistic, cautiously. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, it's not up to Trump. It's not up to any of those guys. It's how much we can shift the culture, and the culture and our ability to make any gains for the unborn really rests on our ability to organize for civil disobedience. So that's my focus. And once we do our jobs as activists and ignite this movement once again to the level that Operation Rescue was, then we can have our pro-life political party again and hopefully just, you know, annihilate the industry altogether so they don't have any power in any political party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe this is naive, or maybe I'm just being overly optimistic, but it's like, could we get to a place where this just isn't a partisan issue anymore? Yeah. And I think telling these victim stories and showing victim imagery is a powerful way to start peeling back the layers and showing people this is, you know, this, when you talk about late term abortion, here's the pictures of it actually happening. Here are the babies that died as a result of that. And then, you know, slowly walking it back from there to earlier and earlier in pregnancy, just planting those questions in people's minds, like, well, if this is what's happening later in pregnancy, what's happening earlier in pregnancy? And okay. It feels like we're at a neat cultural moment to have that opportunity. So that's what I'm hoping for. I hope people see it as a human rights issue, and, you know, whatever political influence people have, whatever cultural influence people have, hopefully we can band together and see some good movement. Teresa, thank you for joining us today, founder and director of Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising. Tell people where they can find you, learn more about Justice for the Five, follow that progress.
Thank you so much. Please follow POW. That's our acronym, Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising, also known as POW. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at PAAUNOW. So please connect with us and visit our website. We have an entire page dedicated to Justice for the Five. There are links you can click on. It tells the complete story from beginning to end, with documentation and pictures with timestamps. So, and please feel free to reach out to us if you want to get involved or have any questions.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Teresa. Your work is very inspiring. Your story is inspiring. And I hope people are encouraged to take action as a result of hearing more of your story.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to Dear Jane.
You can follow along every day on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And make sure you also are subscribed so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. Ring that bell so you're notified and you never miss an episode.